Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jim Bettinger, director of the Knight Journalism Fellowships at Stanford University, and I will be your chair and moderator for this program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and want to remind everyone that you can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers, Lowell Bergman and Stephen Talbot. Both of our speakers today are veteran journalists who will examine the legal and monetary challenges facing the news media today. Their comments are based on their work as producer and correspondent for the upcoming PBS Frontline four-part series entitled News War. Lowell Bergman's career in journalism spans more than 35 years. He is a producer and correspondent for the PBS series Frontline and a professor at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. He has also been an investigative reporter for the New York Times, where he shared a Pulitzer Prize for public service reporting in 2004. For more than 14 years, Mr. Bergman was a producer at the CBS News magazine 60 Minutes, where he did more than 50 stories ranging from organized crime to the Persian Gulf War. The story of his investigation of the tobacco industry was chronicled in the Academy Award winning film The Insider, where he was portrayed by Al Pacino. Mr. Bergman has received numerous Emmys, 5 DuPont Columbia University Awards, and 3 Peabodys. Stephen Talbot has been a producer and writer for PBS Frontline since 1992. His documentaries include The Best Campaign Money Can Buy, Rush Limbaugh's America, Spying on Saddam, and Why America Hates the Press. Mr. Talbot began his television journalism career at KQED in San Francisco, and his articles on politics and culture have appeared in Salon, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Washington Post, among others. He also edits Frontline's international news magazine, Frontline World, where he and his colleagues won the Edward R. Murrow Award from the Overseas Press Club for coverage of international affairs in 2005. Tonight, Lowell Bergman will speak first on the current challenges facing journalists, and then Stephen Talbot will address economic issues confronting the media. Please welcome Lowell Bergman.
Thank you, and as you can see, I'm not Al Pacino. This series that Frontline will air starting on February 13th was funded by the Richard and Rhoda Goldman Fund here in San Francisco and in a grant to the Graduate School of Journalism at Berkeley. And in many ways, it was fitting that it start in San Francisco with funding and work here at the University in Berkeley, because many of the things that are now confronting the journalism community in general, particularly on a legal basis, for some reason, the sort of perfect storm that's been created over the last number of years on these issues is starting out and winding up here in San Francisco. As we stand here tonight, there is a journalist, the first video blogger in the history of the United States, doing time in a federal penitentiary just east of here. There are two reporters in San Francisco who are facing jail time if the Ninth Circuit here in San Francisco doesn't change the situation, and sometime in February. There is a federal court case currently down the street in front of the federal district court, which involves the consolidation of 14 cases from around the United States where the Bush administration is claiming that state secrets require that all these cases be dismissed. These are cases that resulted from reporting on the National Security Administration's domestic eavesdropping program. So San Francisco, in many ways, has become the first, if you will, surge of this perfect storm that's been developing around these issues. The case that is determinant in many of these confidential source issues that you've heard about is a case called Brandsburg that goes back to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1972. That, again, was a case that originated here in the San Francisco area. And I thought I'd give a little bit of background about that, because the first hour, as I should explain, of this documentary series will focus on the issue of confidential sources, the use of it by the press, and its future. The second hour, by the way, will be about national security reporting, the kind of reporting that you can, that in the United States is one of the only countries in the world where you can actually do that kind of reporting and not go immediately to jail. And the third hour, which Steve will talk about, is really about what's happening to the news and the economic situation in the news-gathering industry. And I use the term perfect storm because when you think about these issues, very often we go back to the Nixon administration and we think about the confrontation between the press and the Nixon administration. And one of the things to keep in mind when you think about those comparisons is that there is a number of very major differences. One, the most fundamental difference, which Steve will talk about, is that at that time, 35 years ago, the news gathering industry was a very profitable industry. It was an oligopoly in television, and it was a monopoly in local areas, in metropolitan areas. In those days, the news industry that stood up to the Nixon administration had a pretty sound economic base. Today, that base is dissolving. The news industry's economic model is foundering, and it is desperately looking for a way out. So in some ways, the storm that's developing around us is different and potentially much more dangerous. But to take us back to its origins, at least legally, back to the Brandsburg case, you have to understand that before 1970, there really wasn't much in the way of protection for journalists in this country on the issue of confidential sources and the ability to talk to people and not have to give up your information if you were subpoenaed. And as it developed, and actually in an interview we did the other day with, you remember, Ed Meese, who was also locally in the Bay Area, he reminded me that in the good old days, in the early 1960s, the cops and their reporters were cooperating all the time. There was no such thing as a confidential source or reporters actually not being cooperative with law enforcement. The development of that separation of reporters as watchdogs took place in the late 60s and early 70s. And Brandsburg brought a lot of that to a head, because what was happening was the federal government was very interested in the Black Panther Party. And there was a reporter for the New York Times named Earl Caldwell who had managed to get inside the Black Panther Party and was writing about it. And as when you see the documentary, you'll see Mr. Caldwell talk about how he was approached by the FBI and asked to cooperate. He refused. They subpoenaed him. And that, along with another Black Panther case out of New Haven, Connecticut, and a case involving drug dealers, all went up to the Supreme Court. In 1972, the Supreme Court decided that while in certain limited cases reporters do have a privilege, they do not have a privilege when it comes to not giving information to a federal grand jury. Now, what was interesting in that period, and in our telling of that story that I learned, is that soon after the press lost that decision, the government decided not to ask the reporters to testify, nor did it want their notes. And that because of what followed in its wake, because of Watergate and various things that took place afterwards, the Justice Department issued guidelines. Those guidelines are still in place, which make it very difficult for a federal prosecutor to subpoena a reporter. There was a truce declared. And as I think we learned in the course of doing this documentary, that truce is now over. There is a war, a new war, between the media and the government, an unsettled period that is going on right now. And that's why the reporters here in San Francisco are facing jail. That's why Mr. Wolf is facing jail. And that's why in a couple of weeks you're going to see an unprecedented line of reporters walking into federal court in Washington, D.C., testifying. 35 years ago, when these issues seemed to be resolved, reporters were seen as watchdogs. We were, in a sense, had a very good image. There was another movie done, All the President's Men, and we were stars. We were somehow the protectors of the people. Today, in the light of what happened around the Valerie Plame case and what we call Plamegate, reporters are no longer the watchdogs. Reporters are witnesses. And the government of the United States seems to now be emboldened to do that into the future. There doesn't seem to be any way legally to stop it, unless there is, in fact, in Congress or in amongst the public, some rising up against it. But I wanted, you know, there was an issue that came up in the course of doing the reporting for this documentary, which is one that we spend some time with, which is, are things different than they were 35 years ago? And as one person we interviewed said, what's going on today in many ways is Richard Nixon's revenge. That he didn't last long enough to do what is happening now to the press. And just to give you an idea, if you go online to the Frontline website tomorrow, it's pbs.org/frontline, you'll find something that we came across in the course of our research. Back in 1991, a professor named Karen Olmsted at the University of California, Davis, doing her dissertation, came across a pile of papers at the Gerald Ford Library. And the papers were in the file marked Dick Cheney. At the time, he was the assistant to the chief of staff to Gerald Ford, Donald Rumsfeld. And in the file, she found something that we're going to post on the web, which is the handwritten notes of Dick Cheney. Okay? And the handwritten notes of Dick Cheney and the related documents that you'll see talk about, well, I'll read it to you. 529-75, problem, colon, unauthorized disclosure of classified national security information by Cy Hirsch and the New York Times. And then it proceeds to give you the minutes of a meeting between Mr. Cheney and the Attorney General of the United States and a representative of the CIA, in which they discuss whether or not to prosecute the New York Times for espionage, I think you've heard that recently, whether or not to get search warrants for Mr. Hirsch's house, whether or not to notify the news media in general in person about why they shouldn't publish matters like this, and in the end, something that we discovered in the course of this research. Before they can start an investigation for a national security leak, the procedure in the U.S. government is that they have to get a complaining agency. So as a result of this meeting, the Attorney General sent a letter to the director of the CIA. And what he does in these letters, these started in 1969, is he asks the complaining agency, and it's in the file that you can see online tomorrow, 11 questions. These were 11 questions apparently written and approved by J. Edgar Hoover. And amongst the questions, in this version, it's question number 3, is, was the classified leak true? As if an FBI official explains to us in the documentary, if it's not true, there's no violation of the law. So the follow-up question to him was, so if we hear that there's a national security leak investigation, that means that the story is true. And he said, yes, we are, in fact, he agreed, the fact-checkers for the American public. You'll see this process going on in this file of what goes on. But there's a fundamental question at the end of the process and in the memos. Mr. Hirsch wrote a story about how the United States was eavesdropping on the Soviet Union using submarines to go within Soviet territorial waters and tap into undersea cables. So the question becomes in the documents, do we go public and announce a leak investigation? And if we do that, will that bring more attention to the stories? So they query the Department of Defense and the Navy to find out, is there any indication since the publication of the stories that the Soviets have stopped talking, that they realize we're eavesdropping on them? And the answer they get back is, it doesn't look like they read his story or that they believed it. So they decide not to prosecute. So it's a good inside look at how what we now see going on today. There is a national security leak investigation of the New York Times and its reporters for doing this NSA eavesdropping story. There are people who have called for the prosecution of the New York Times. Congressman Peter King, there's been a resolution through Congress calling for an espionage investigation of the news media. And these kinds of actions are not only intimidating, but may represent a new unprecedented war on the media, especially at a time when we don't have the same robust economic model that we had in the past. And with that, I'll introduce my colleague, Steve. And by the way, you should understand, Steve is producing the third hour. The first 2 hours, I should credit Rainey Aronson, who's the producer of the first 2 hours, which will be out of New York, and that there's a large group of people here involved, both students from the University of California, former students, and people around the country. And one of the difficulties of doing this, you should understand, is that doing a series about the news media by those of us in the news media has not only presented certain great difficulties, but a reaffirmation in my mind of one of the things I've learned about my colleagues before. It's not that we don't have, that we have thin skins, we have no skins. Thank you.
So my role in all this, as Lowell mentioned, is to produce this third episode. Again, the series will be broadcast in February nationally on Frontline here on KQED. This episode that I'm about to talk about will be February 27th. 10 years ago, I did this before for Frontline. I was roped into it by Sharon Tiller, who's an executive at Frontline and who happens to be Lowell's wife. And that show was called Why America Hates the Press. And no one would be the correspondent for that show. Everyone at Frontline said, terrific idea, Steve, go get them. The press, especially that celebrity press corps in Washington, they really need to be taken down a notch. But you know, I like to do lunch in Washington and in New York, and we really don't want to rile Cokie Roberts and Sam Donaldson and Bob Woodward. So one of the great pleasures of working on this series, and it's not always a pleasure, is working with Lowell, because Lowell doesn't care about who he does lunch with. Incidentally, the big expose in that series, which seems extraordinarily quaint now, given the problems that we're in these days with the government and the media, as Lowell's talked about, our big expose was that the McLaughlin Report was staged. I know that comes as a great shock to many of you, but at the time, the McLaughlin Report, which was really one of the first reports to have the shout fests that we've come to know way too much about, McLaughlin always introduced every show saying, this is an absolutely spontaneous, unrehearsed show. They made a big point of that. And it turned out it was completely the opposite. It was the most staged thing on TV except for professional wrestling. And we found this out because one of the guests, who was sort of a third-tier guest on the show, was called in the summer, and he tape-recorded the message he got from the producer of the show, who outlined what everyone would say on the show, who would ask the questions, what their answers would be, roughly, and in what order all this would happen. So we recorded this. He listened to the message on the phone. Then we got the tape of that episode of the show and intercut his getting the instructions on the phone with the show, which played out exactly as he was told to do it. And then we intercut it with pro wrestling just to drive the... So this episode, which is called What's Happening to the News, is about the pressures, both corporate pressures, economic pressures on the media, and the most phenomenal change of all, really, the impact of the web, which is a truly disruptive media, new media, that has just shaken traditional media, newspaper, TV, even radio, to its foundations, and is profoundly changing the business model of these traditional news media. So as best we can in this hour, we're trying to look at those two forces, the corporate pressures on newspapers and television and the disruptive force of the web, and to look at what opportunities there are, but also the real challenges that this poses for us. And we start where else these days with The Daily Show. There was an announcement today that, a rumor, I should say, that The Daily Show is being courted by the Washington Post, WashingtonPost.com, which has a very developed website, to cover the 98 presidential election. So this comedy show, which mocks what we do, is now being drawn more and more, of course, into mainstream coverage, partly because they do such a good job at deconstructing what a bad job so many of my colleagues do. One of the funniest things that happened, I think, a couple of years ago was that the TV critics, who Lowell is going to go talk to in Pasadena on Saturday about this series, the TV critics voted The Daily Show the best news show in America. And I hate to say, but we were up against them frontline that year. We've won that in the past, as was 60 Minutes. So it was a great provocative award on their behalf. And more substantively, recently there has been a university study, professor in the Midwest, who studied network news and found that substantively there was as much coverage of the news, as much hard news in The Daily Show as there was in network news broadcasts. That when you took the 22 minutes of a network news broadcast, minus the commercials, and you threw out the fluff, you threw out Katie Couric talking about home recipes and so forth, and got down to what was actually news, and then you looked through The Daily Show and you took out the obvious jokes, it's a comedy show after all, took out the obvious jokes, but then they have guests, President Musharraf of Pakistan was on, Bill Clinton, you name it, actually they sometimes even make news. You found, and they deconstruct the news in a way that we might do in a journalism class at the Graduate School of Journalism in Berkeley. The night we were there filming with them, CNN had launched a whole week of programming they called Fear Not Facts. And it was at the time when there was the incident with liquids being brought on perhaps as bombs and planes and all the airports in an uproar. And this was the most out of control, anxiety provoking coverage you could possibly get, with booming voices, fear, not facts, you know. And then they would go in to this horribly fear inducing reporting, which Jon Stewart and his producers took apart in a very systematic way. And he says, they're using the fear voice with the fear music and the fear font, which was all true. So it can be, not always, but it can be a very engaging lesson. And when we were there, we interviewed David Javerbaum, who is he was the head writer, he's now the executive producer of the show. And he said, look, we're a comedy show. He's very depressed by watching the news. He says Jon Stewart's a lot tougher man than he and can actually watch cable news all day. He can't take it anymore. But he told us, I personally, through this job, through working this job, have come to feel that the news media is even more depressing than the news it attempts and fails miserably to report. I think it's horrible news broadcast horribly. That's a fairly blanket statement, but I've been doing this job for a long time, delving into it every day. It's a thoroughly depressing business. But to the extent that people look to us as a source of news, that is 100% indicative of other people's failures and not our success. So that's a long introduction to how we begin this show. And as I mentioned at the start, what we look at are the pressures that the traditional news media are facing, which we feel are diminishing or degrading the quality of the news that we watch, we listen to, or we read. To take the corporate ownership issue, the demands for profits, we focus on the Los Angeles Times. Now, I know a lot of you are in the media. I see a lot of friends in the audience, so I'm not going to belabor this, and we'll take your questions. But the essence of this story, as many of you know, is that in 2000, the Tribune Company of Chicago, big media corporation, purchased the Times Mirror Corporation, Los Angeles, owner of the LA Times. So for the first time in 120 years, the Chandler family, which had founded and built the LA Times, sold it, kind of in a moment of panic. They sold it, and since then, the Times newsroom has gone from 1,200 people, perhaps bloated, perhaps too many, but 1,200 people, down to close to 900 now. So there have been a steady series of cuts that the Tribune Corporation has imposed on the LA Times staff, and they're continuing to demand more, mainly because the deal went south. They spent $8.3 billion to acquire Times Mirror. They had a lot of ideas for synergy and convergence, buying Newsday on Long Island, combining it with a TV station in New York, having a TV station, KTLA, and the Times in Los Angeles, thinking they could sell national advertising. It didn't work out. So they've been pushing for cuts ever since. John Carroll, the editor they brought in to the LA Times, did very good journalism while he was there, but ended up agreeing to many of the cuts, finally couldn't stomach it anymore, left in the summer of 2005. He passed the baton to his protege, Dean Baquet, only African-American editor of a major newspaper in the United States. He'd come from the New York Times, very qualified guy. He also continued making cuts, but trying to fight the good fight, hold the line. What was interesting about the case is that his publisher, a man, Jeffrey Johnson, who was a 22-year veteran of the Tribune Corporation, came out to Los Angeles. He'd been there for a while, but got this job as publisher. And eventually, he and Baquet teamed up. He began to look at the world the way Baquet did, and John Carroll before him had. And he, on the front page of his own paper in Los Angeles, announced that newspapers can't cut their way into the future. And 2 weeks later, he was fired. Incidentally, interesting development in Los Angeles is that many people in the community, many civic leaders who worry about how you govern a city like Los Angeles, huge population, so many different racial and ethnic groups, so many languages, sprawling city, always had a problem holding itself together with a center, they worry about having an institution like the LA Times not be locally owned. So former Secretary of State Warren Christopher and others, 20 community leaders representing Urban League, AFL-CIO, Chamber of Commerce, signed a public statement to the Tribune Company, don't lay off more people at the paper. We need the LA Times. Tribune Company has not taken that advice. The surprising thing in all this is that the Los Angeles Times, like many newspapers, while it's losing circulation, is making a lot of money. The Los Angeles Times, it turns out, makes a 20% profit a year. They take in $1 billion in revenues, ad sales and so forth, and they make $200 million a year. So that's double the average of a Fortune 500 company, and many major newspapers in the United States make that kind of money. John Carroll was saying that if a paper like the LA Times would be allowed to make, say, 10%, still quite a healthy profit, he felt that the paper could be very prosperous, would not have to lay off staff, would be able to invest money in its future, which is the web, which is in going online more and more, and in continuing to promote the paper. But they obviously didn't listen to John Carroll. He's at Harvard now, the Shorenstein Center, writing a book on the future of the news. Several billionaires have stepped forward in Los Angeles, saying they would be willing to buy the LA Times. David Geffen is one of them, Ron Burkle, another, Eli Broad, who Lowell interviewed for this show. And interestingly enough, Broad said, when Lowell pressed him, that he would be perfectly willing to accept 5, 6, 7% profit. Now, obviously, local owners, billionaires, you hope they're benevolent, like families that own papers, the Sulzbergers and the New York Times, the Grahams, the Washington Post. Lowell pressed him and said, would you interfere with the editorial policy, for instance, of the LA Times? And he sat back in front of one of his paintings. He's he's a big museum guy and owner of modern art. And he said, I might. And when we pushed him on that, basically what he said, he'd like to see the LA Times have more coverage of museums and high art. He also said he would sign a statement that he would stay away from pushing the editorial direction of the Times. And he said he would continue to employ Dean Baquet, who he admired tremendously. And when we told that to Dean Baquet, he pointed out that he thought Eli Broad was the handsomest billionaire he'd ever met. (Laughter) Why does this matter with the LA Times? It matters because it's a paper that under Carroll and Biquet won 13 Pulitzer Prizes in 5 years, more than any other newspaper in the United States during that period. They were stories that ranged from detailed coverage of Russia, post-Soviet Russia, homelessness in Los Angeles. They're one of the few papers to have a continuous, maintain a continuous bureau in Iraq and bring us important news from Iraq. They've done local. They should do more local coverage of the LA Times. That's always been a knock about the paper, and it's true. But they have also done tremendous reporting, got a Pulitzer for a public hospital, Drew, in South Central Los Angeles. Really the exact kind of reporting we ought to be doing, the sort of reporting Lowell was doing with the Times and Frontline on dangerous business about companies that were jeopardizing workers' lives, the kind of things that don't necessarily immediately, they're not sexy stories, they're not stories that immediately sell your paper, but they're the public interest, public service kinds of stories that newspapers ought to be doing. So it matters what happens to papers like the LA Times. And I'm going to quickly just mention the web here so we can get to questions. But there's a lot of promise on the web. I love a lot of web journalism. Bloggers have broken some stories. Very interesting story in the San Francisco Chronicle today, page 2, about a local blogger who's calling KSFO to task for what he regards as hate speech on the radio. So bloggers have called attention to our failings in the media, have broken some stories themselves, which we're covering in the documentary. But my brother, full disclosure, started Salon Magazine. Salon has broken some stories. So I'm a believer in a lot of the web journalism that can be done. But it's nowhere near at the level of what newspapers have done in this country. And newspapers are one of the few institutions that employ large numbers of news gatherers. So when you go to a guy like John Carroll and he says, I've been looking into this, he estimates 85% of the original reporting in the United States is done by newspapers. And the online revenue that is being generated, and everyone's going online, even 60 Minutes, Lowell's old employer, Jeff Fager, the executive producer, he's cut a deal with Yahoo so that they now post 60 Minute stories chunked up so you can info snack, as they say it, 60 Minutes stories on the Yahoo News website. And that audience that looks at 60 Minutes on the website is 20 years younger than the audience that looks at 60 Minutes on TV. So they're very excited about that. And everyone's trying to make their deals. But the revenue that that's bringing in right now is very, very small. So we're in this dangerous period economically for the news media, where the traditional news gatherers who are still doing the lion's share of the work that our democracy depends on, that our social discourse depends on, are losing revenue. They're losing circulation. And yet the web has not yet been able to generate the kind of revenue that it would take to support large numbers of professional news gatherers out in the field, bringing us the real reporting that we need. So that's the moment that we're in. That's what we're zeroing in on this in this episode, what's happening to the news, and hope you watch. Thank you.
Our thanks to journalists Lowell Bergman and Steve Talbot for their comments today on the legal and financial challenges confronting journalists. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And now it's time for our audience question period. We have quite a few questions, so let's get to them. Actually, at the start, I'm going to sort of combine three questions here because I think they bear on each other. Why has the news become more entertainment than hard news? How much do you believe the lines between gossip and genuine reporting have been blurred? And is the American public not demanding enough of journalism today?
Okay, you want me to
go? Okay.
Well, there are the definition of news, and as we were getting into this, it seemed that the cautionary tale about all this is what's happened to news gathering on television. The definition of news once was serious information in the public interest, or as some people defined it when we interviewed them, news is anything that's hidden, everything else is advertising. The fact is that over the last 25 years, due to by the way, changes in technology, the development of cable television and competition from cable, the digital revolution, so on, has fragmented the television audience. The result is that, and that along with deregulation of television broadcasting so that, in fact, the requirements for a license are no longer enforced. That is, that you operate in the public interest and necessity if you hold a license. It's a lesson I usually use in school and at university at Berkeley in the seminar. The question is, what's the most lucrative license that the U.S. government issues? A broadcasting license. How much does it cost the broadcaster to get a license? A new license is $250. 8-year renewals, $100. It doesn't matter whether the broadcaster in question is worth $1,000 or $100 million. So it's a license that technically belongs to the public. It's not enforced. And since the mid-1980s. That deregulation process means that the definition of news can be entertainment. There is no line between the two. And so as we and by the way, these films are in progress, so in one version of the films, which may not make it because for time reasons, but in one version of the film that Steve is producing, we go into the fact that television news has now lost exactly that, its definition. And we ask, and I think this is still in Weston is still in there, and the president of ABC News, in an interview, we read to him the lineup on primetime, their magazine show, that night. Teenage girl gets 10 years for oral sex, Amish sex, teenagers bullied in high school. Is that news? So the definition of news has changed in the last 25 years, led by this change in what was a regulated industry, the broadcasting industry, and is spreading everywhere. Now, competition, hopefully the free market in some fashion, as we today, will elevate that definition, but that's yet to be seen.
This one's for Steve. Did you find or do you have any ideas for the renewed financial stability of major newspapers or other important foundations of our news culture?
I have the magic solution. No, I wish I did. I mean, one of the things is to go nonprofit. I mean, if you think about where you get the news now, how many of you are regular listeners of National Public Radio? All right. I'm with you. Nonprofit. And a healthy donation from the Kroc estate, which always helps. The St. Petersburg Times, which is the largest newspaper in Florida, does some very strong, tough reporting, is also run by the Poynter Institute, which is a nonprofit foundation. Owned by them, you're right. So they have to make money. They live in the real world, but they're insulated, they're buffered to a certain extent, where they can go out and do tough reporting, where they risk lawsuits, and they don't have to be held to the same profit standards that Wall Street holds publicly owned newspapers to. Dean Baquet at one point said to us, "Wall Street is my enemy." And we asked that of a woman named Lauren Rich Fine, who's a vice president of Merrill Lynch, newspaper analyst, and she said he's absolutely right. Wall Street is the enemy of publicly owned newspaper editors these days. So one thing to look at is the nonprofit solution. Another solution for publicly owned newspapers to get out of the constant pressure for higher and higher demands for profits is to go private. And that's why you have, for vanity reasons, for power reasons, for philanthropic reasons, whatever, a number of very wealthy people all across the country, not just in L.A. with the L.A. Times, but in Boston and Philadelphia and other cities, stepping forward to say, I want to buy a newspaper back from a chain now.
I continue to be flabbergasted at the mainstream media's continual bemoaning the disruptive challenges of new media channels, formats, and so on, webs, blogs, and et cetera. It's like listening to IBM complain about how computer users are moving away from mainframes. Why can't they accept the changes and figure out how to adopt them in order to deliver the news in new and profitable ways?
Well, I think there are two different realities here that yet haven't come together. The first is, as many people we interviewed in the mainstream media, when we talked to them about the internet and the complaints of bloggers and others, is that if we didn't exist, they'd have to invent us. The fact is, as Steve mentioned, is that most of the new information every day that gets that the web people on the web can comment on, manipulate, or use comes from the mainstream media. That the main news gatherers in the United States, especially with the decline of network television news gathering, the closing of bureaus, and so on, are newspapers. The bloggers, the people on the web who are trying to do things related to the news haven't yet gotten to the point where they are a major supplier, and that's of new information. And that's the thing that I think Steve was trying to get to, which is that the economic model of the web does not produce enough money to support the kind of news gathering that we're used to in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, or any of the major newspapers in the United States. Some of the newspaper chains that we've talked to say, well, maybe our internet revenue is somewhere between 1/30th or 1/20th of our regular newspaper revenue. Or we saw a very interesting statistic the other day that to a print version of a newspaper, a subscriber is worth $1,000. To their online edition, someone clicking onto their online edition, they're worth $5. So if the scale is such that you would not have, and that's the dilemma right now. That's the central question.
And interestingly enough, Eric Schmidt, who we interviewed, the CEO of Google, said we are critically, Google, this is, he's talking about, the 800-pound gorilla in the media world these days, which has been very helpful in many ways. I Google all the time. Google is critically dependent on newspapers. I mean, if Google loses newspapers, he says he's very worried about people learning things that are true and vetted and edited. And he, in fact, now, one of the reasons he probably gave us the interview, is that Google is working on some new algorithm that'll help sort out, he says, things that are more likely to be true from things that are less likely to be true. So when they're presented, they're ranked on some kind of Google system that way in the future. But he talks about the future sort of on the one hand saying, look, it's inevitable. If you bet against the internet, you're going to lose. Get out of the way. This is the new world of the media. It's coming. It's coming fast. It's happening. Things are controlled by the end user. This is what they want. It's welcome to the world of blogging, MyFace, YouTube, etc. It's happening. But he's genuinely worried about the unintended consequence, he would say, of doing in serious large institutions that gather the news.
Do traditional journalistic standards have a place on the internet? And are those standards worth saving, or do they need to be reinvented?
Yes. They don't need to be reinvented, in my opinion. I think that we have an unusual development over the last half century, which is the professionalization of news standards inside the United States. And so that, you know, 40 years ago when I started out, newspaper reporters were simply ink-stained wretches. If you worked over at the San Francisco Examiner, you spent most of the day at the M&M bar. And you really weren't out there operating on the same standards that exist today. And the idea that we have a professionalized news, not just organizations, but cadre of people who are trained to find things out, to check them, to do various things, to provide quality information, makes us the leader in the world, basically, in that kind of reporting. And what we are in danger of is losing that standard, given what's going on.
A well-known Harvard law professor stated at a recent Commonwealth Club event that reporters are no different from other citizens when they are subpoenaed to testify in court. Why should reporters have a right not to give up sources when they testify?
Well, that's a history lesson that you can watch the first hour of the documentary. But to summarize it, there wasn't any real privilege for reporters before 35 years ago. It came because, one, I think journalism and journalists proved that they had a watchdog role in society and could operate in the public interest, even in a profit, even for profit-making organizations. And so, therefore, the courts have recognized both in 49 states, either by law or by precedent, and to a certain extent in federal decisions, that there exists this privilege for this particular group of people. One of the difficulties with making it more specific is that journalists are, in a sense, anarchists. Journalists don't want to be licensed. Journalism is actually a privilege given to you to all of us under the Constitution. And the line between when you're a professional journalist and deserve that privilege and when you're just a citizen, if you will, an ordinary citizen, hasn't been well defined. Over the last 35 years, however, and particularly during the 1970s, journalists were willing to go to jail for extended periods of time to prove that they could protect their sources. And it seems to be repeating itself today.
The Washington Post recently gave a number of journalists buyouts and then left them write for the newspaper as freelancers. Most photojournalists for news magazines are freelancers. Is this trend deprofessionalizing journalism?
No.
All right.
You know, there are some very interesting developments, and we get into this with a lot of people who are true believers in the new blogosphere that we're entering, about people, average people, ordinary people, being able to report news or do acts of journalism. And we've all seen examples of it, and a lot of times they have political consequences. People with their cell phones catching politicians saying things that they shouldn't see. The woman who reported about the tsunami because she was on vacation and she could have her cell phone. So that's fine. That's good. I'm all for that. I think one of the things that we have come to see in reporting this is that there's plenty of room for a lot of people. The question is, even in the case of newspapers, someone like John Carroll would say, he's very sentimental about newspapers. His father was a newspaper editor. He's been the editor of three newspapers. He loves newspapers. But he says, it's not even newspapers I want to preserve. It's the staff of newspapers. It's the large group of trained professionals who can actually go out and have support behind them. When you're sued, have people stand up behind you who will back you up to go up against the government when you have to go up against the government, to go up against the police. I mean, it's very difficult to do that as a freelancer and as an individual or as an isolated blogger. So I think Carol's concern, and I would say certainly mine at this point, is looking towards the future. How do you defend whether everything exists, there's no more paper anymore, all the media is on a screen, we're all looking in computer screens? Okay, fine. But what about the people who are going to do it, preserving their jobs, defending them, allowing them to do the serious, in-depth reporting that we come to expect?
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speakers today are Lowell Bergman and Stephen Talbot, correspondent and producer of the PBS television series Frontline, who are discussing the legal and financial challenges confronting journalists. Question about bias in journalism, real or perceived, the so-called liberal media, Fox News. As reporting moves down to the common man with citizen journalism, how do you feel the issue of personal bias can or should be handled to allow for more disclosure, more transparency, a more trustworthy news system?
I think the transparency issue is one that has been central to most mainstream media organizations over the last 5 years, not just because of the Internet. Obviously, things that people come up with on the Internet and catch mistakes and so on have resulted in various situations, whether it was Dan Rather and the National Guard story or other similar situations. But we've had Jason Blair, we've had various cases involving fabrication, and so that combined with questions about bias have in certain ways undermined the credibility of mainstream media in particular, and there's been a pounding that's gone on by what I would call the right-wing media in general on the nature of what we would call professional journalism. I think this is a period that will change, and that's not new. There's always been attacks on the messenger, and one of the better examples of this came from John Carroll, actually, about the standing of reporters, and he told us that when he went to work as a reporter in 1973 for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the chief investigative reporter at the paper had just been arrested and sent to the penitentiary for extortion. So the standards in journalism, from bias to conduct, have always had their ups and downs, just like in any other profession.
I just want to add quickly, there is actually a fourth episode to this series. We're not working on it, but it's this other part of Frontline that I work on, Frontline World, and it's looking at global media. And one of the stories that will air March 27th, and one of the stories we're doing with a reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle, Vanessa Waugh, and it's a story about the citizen journalist paper, online paper in South Korea called Oh My News. And it's a very interesting story about the development of that paper, which does rely on thousands of citizen journalists to send them stories for which they're paid very small amounts of money. And then if you like the story, I've always liked this part, readers can tip them. And a lot of ordinaries send money. So that's very intriguing to me. They do at Oh My News actually have a staff of professional journalists and reporters who do write some stories themselves and edit and help select what comes at them. So it's not just everything that comes up. But it's a very interesting story. So that's in the Global Media Hour and Frontline World, March 27th.
With all the problems newspapers face, doesn't one have to mention that often for understandable reasons, that much of the public has a great disinterest now in issues deserving analysis? Do you think that's a factor?
Well, I think it's always been a problem getting the public interested in what we would call serious issues, and I think it all depends upon what the circumstances are at the time. You may have noticed, for instance, to my surprise, and I think a lot of people's surprise, that about 3 years ago, the Bush administration and the Federal Communications Commission wanted to lift the limit on the number of stations that various media organizations could buy. There was no coverage of this issue in the media in general, broadcasting or TV or print. You might have looked at the Wall Street Journal and the back pages of it; it would appear. Out of nowhere, the public rose up and wrote all these letters to the FCC, and there was almost a popular movement, a movement that resulted in the repeal of the attempt to do exactly that. So some things happen, you know, by the public without the media and the news media being directly involved or even having to do any reporting.
It's a question about blogs. Do you expect more use of blogs by experts, trained professionals, whistleblowers, and the like? And can this augment the traditional role of true investigative journalism?
Yes.
Would you like to expand on it?
No, I mean, I think that's going to happen. I mean, we've always in the media gone to people like that for sources and information. We certainly don't know everything ourselves. We're generalists, usually. And I think that one of the great things about the web is it does allow people to self-publish. So there are a lot of academics now who do have websites. Sorting through, I mean, honestly, and this, I know I sound cranky and old now, but I mean, sorting through all the blogs to find out which the ones you want. I mean, I've got a few favorites that I go to all the time now, but I don't have that much time to look into a computer screen.
Is the breakdown in the government journalism truce over subpoenaing sources a product of this particular administration, the Bush administration, or is it a broader trend?
The breakdown is relatively recent. The reasons behind it, however, are very complicated, the way this happened. In many ways, what we now call Plamegate, or the trial that's about to begin in Washington of Scooter Libby, came about because of unintended consequences of what people were trying to do. For instance, it was the liberal columnists and the editorial pages of the New York Times that did a drumbeat in the summer of 2003 for a special prosecutor in that investigation. It's now clear that there was no violation of the original federal law that people thought it was a violation of it, but the result has been that the reporters have been subpoenaed. And that process, which Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, initiated, appears now to have emboldened the Justice Department itself to begin subpoenaing reporters right here in San Francisco. Not on questions of national security, but in the San Francisco case, this has to do with grand jury information. And so you have an unprecedented situation. In addition to the jailing of Josh Wolf, who today sits, I think in first week of February, he'll set a new record for a reporter being in jail. And there, the bloggers, I would hope, would take more interest in the fate of one of their own.
It's a question about the public attitude towards the press. How do you believe the average citizen views reporters, with respect, suspicion, or loathing?
Why America Hates the Press was the title of the show I did 10 years ago. I mean, look, we, somewhere down there with lawyers, politicians, we don't have a very high, we're not high in the public esteem for a lot of reasons, many of which are our own fault. Certain arrogance on the part of the mainstream media, the fact, I could go on and on. But I also think that there has been a relentless drumbeat from the right in this country to attack the media, to tear down the media. And I think that takes a toll.
Do you think journalism needs an official ombudsman-like organization, similar to the role that the American Medical Association plays with doctors, the American Bar Association with lawyers, and why or why not?
I think most news organizations now have ombudsmen themselves in response to those kinds of complaints. But it's much more, as I tried to say earlier, I mean, journalists are in a sense, come from an anarchist tradition, which they like. And it's very hard to get them to go to meetings. It's very hard to get them to talk to each other. In some newsrooms, journalists are the least verbal people you could imagine, the editors especially. Somehow they communicate, but it's hard to know how. By the way, we can be held accountable. I've been sued. Lots of journalists have been sued. There's lots of struggles over facts and what's not facts. It does happen in this country. It's a little more difficult in this country to win a libel suit. But on the other hand, unlike in England, you don't have to pay the other side their legal fees if you lose. So this is a country that does have some checks and balances to a great extent in the media. The question is, to me, the definition of what is news. And that's one of the reasons I think people don't trust us, because news is presented at times that, when you look at it, isn't really in the public interest. And they call it news.
The thing I find most annoying about many news programs is their reliance on outside experts who lie through their teeth. Is there a hope of ending this reliance on experts and hearing truth on the news?
We were talking when we were back in the green room before that even someone like Ted Koppel, who would rely on someone like Henry Kissinger over and over and over again. Turns out, Henry Kissinger offered Ted Koppel a job. Way back, that he told us just recently when we interviewed him, he thought long and hard about taking. So they had a lot of close relations, or a close relationship in some ways. But, Koppel always had this style of interviewing people where the person's the deer in the headlight look. If you've ever been interviewed on a show like that, you're stuck in front of the camera and he has total control over it because he's... But they all have their Rolodexes in Washington, and he would be the first to say that you push some person too hard and they don't come back on your show. One reason the NewsHour on PBS gets all the politicians to show up is that Jim Lehrer often does very soft interviews with them. So anyway, and then there's the old thing that, is a cliche of our business where we always have to have the debate. There always has to be two sides, even if one side's patently ridiculous. So.
Since the time of Nixon, is there any clear, unambiguous evidence of the executive branch using the national security to smother information solely for domestic political reasons?
Well, I think they would probably argue over what the domestic political reasons are, but I think that, as we did in our interviews, major newspaper editors will tell you that they have sat on stories or not run stories because the government of the United States has told them that this will either damage national security or put people's lives in danger. So what the reasons were behind making that claim, making that assertion by a particular administration, you can debate that, but I think that a lot of soul-searching goes on in most news organizations before you run something that you think might create damage, and you don't want to necessarily do it. You don't do it just because you want to get a scoop. There is a sequence that you'll see in the film involving the New York Times, the editor of the New York Times, Bill Keller, in which he's told by the President of the United States in the Oval Office that he will have blood on his hands if the New York Times runs the story. Now, they decided to run the story.
We've unfortunately reached the point in our program where there's time for one last question, and it's something of a follow-up to that. Is there any type of story that you would not report or agree to hold for reasons other than journalism reasons? And what should the standard be?
I'll tell you another story. It's just tangential to that. But part of the pressure on the LA Times and the Tribune Company is to tell them to be a local paper, that there's only room for three national papers in this country, New York Times, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, and that there's no room for a paper like the LA Times to have bureaus all around the world, foreign reporters, reporters in Iraq, Washington. You don't need that. Cover Hollywood, cover entertainment. I'm serious. And that's, you know, there's truth in that. You want to cover your local scene, of course. But don't worry about this stuff. Well, the problem is a paper like that goes away, you're down to fewer and fewer sources. And Bill Keller at the New York Times says, we want the LA Times there because they help keep us honest. It's competition. We want those people. And Dean Baquet, the fired editor, told us a story, great anecdote, where they had a report that the Iranian community, which is quite large in Los Angeles, was being spied on by the CIA, and the CIA was using them to spy on Iran because the CIA didn't have much of a presence inside Iran. And everybody knew this in the Iranian community in Los Angeles and talked about it all the time, and the LA Times decided to run a front page story about this, and they got a call from then head of the CIA, George Tenet, telling them not to. And Dean Baquet, after going over the story carefully with the reporters and getting the background, the context, decided that they had to publish the story. Well, I got to tell you, he relished publishing that story. And there are other stories he's gotten the call, and he hasn't run. He's decided that they were right, and he shouldn't do it. So it's a judgment call. But an editor like Dean Baquet likes to play at that level, likes to be able to get that call to deal with that story, to do national and international stories of importance. And we'd be liars to tell you we don't like to do that stuff.
Our thanks to journalists Lowell Bergman, Stephen Talbot, correspondents for the upcoming PBS Frontline Service, News War. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. I'm Jim Bettinger, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.